Reading from the Brihadbhagavatamrita, Canto 2, Chapter 1, Text 21. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Ye Sarvanada Pekshena Radhadasyet Chavasparam. Sankirtayanti tangnama tadrusha priyatamaya. They chant his names and are full of unique love for him. Indifferent to everything else, they only want to become servants of Radha. Commentary. The devotees of Sri Radha, who is the dearmost beloved of Lord Madan Gopal, are not impersonalists void of desires. They are fully confident that if Sri Radhika accepts them as her servants, everything they desire will be achieved and more. The privilege of serving Sri Radha is the rarest goal of life, and it is fitting that this privilege be attainable only by executing the most excellent of sadhana. That is to say, one could please her divine grace only by the sacrifice of purely chanting the names of Sri Rasika Rasika, the hero of the Rasa dance. In sweet voices, the servants of Sri Radha always melodiously and loudly chant Krishna's names. Such devotees are worthy to engage in such elevated service because their hearts are filled with the supreme variety of spontaneous, ecstatic love for Krishna. Om Jnana Timanandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chaksurin Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Vairagya yud bhakti risham payatnai apayama manadipsamandam kripam buhiya paraduka duki sanatanastam prabhamasriyami. Namo mahabhadanghaya Krishna prema pradayate Krishnaya Krishna chaitanya namne gora shushe namaha. Vanshakalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vayevacha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasudeva Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So greetings from Srinath Mayapur. Unfortunately, when I gave class last week, I had traveled all day, so I'd been here a week, and I was extremely fatigued. I'm not so tired today, but it has been a full day. I give an hour and a half class at 5 o'clock every day, and it's wonderful quality of people, so sincere and studious. So we have between 60 and 80 people coming every day to the class. That's really nice, and have many, many friends in Srinath Mayapur. Every day I go out to lunch. Just many people I've known over the years for 15, 20, 30 years even. So we'll discuss today. This is the second half of the Brihadbhagavatamrita, The first half is the topmost devotees, and the second part, and I guess the third part also, will be the topmost place. And each is a journey of first in the first canto of gradations of devotees as Narada is searching. And his searching brings him to progressively higher and higher places. So the second half will be after Uttara has heard that, and heard that as the essence of the Bhagavatam. The Brihad Bhagavatamrita is the essence of the Bhagavatam. And what is the essence of the Bhagavatam if you study it carefully? It's presenting an exposition of love on different degrees of intimacy, culminating with the highest degree of love, which is the most intimate relationship with Krishna, which is found in Vrindavan. And this book is representing the philosophy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It's done by Sanatana Goswami, one of his most intimate followers. The philosophy based on the Bhagavatam, that the topmost objective and the topmost manifestation of the divine is Krishna, and the highest form of love is love for Krishna in the most intimate way. After all, that's what our conception of Chaitanya is. It's God trying to experience the highest form of pleasure, which is the most intense form of love, which is found in Vrindavan, specifically by the embodiment or epitome of love in Vrindavan, which is Sri Radha, at the height of her love. So the story of Chaitanya is seeking that. Is Krishna seeking to experience that, to become complete in his enjoyment? God has to become his best devotee. So who is Chaitanya? He's one who's seeking that, and he's one who has achieved that, and he's one who has shown how to get that based on Nam Sankirtan, chanting the holy names of God with a sense of sambandha or relationship. Love is the highest motivating force of absorption. So the holy names, it's an expression of love of God, it is God, and the highest absorption in that. Both the expression of love and the manifestation of love is when you have a relationship with the object of your love. So, the highest for Chaitanya, he exemplified this, how to achieve that, how to become a devotee, because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is God trying to become a devotee. So he exemplifies trying to become a devotee, and therefore he is the example for us of trying to become a devotee. So he chanted the holy names of God with sambandha, which is developed by hearing the Bhagavatam, the essence of which is those expressions of love by those topmost devotees. And by hearing about that, one develops an attachment for that, which is actually that, which is that type of love. So this is what the Bhagavatam is. This is what the Brihad Bhagavatam, which is the essence of the Bhagavatam, is. It's, and to help us understand that concept of service and devotion, the full, I don't know if the word is gamut, the full expression of that love is given. One thing that a scholar does, or a scholarly book does, is take a particular concept and put it in a variety of appropriate places so that you can see it from different angles. So the Bhagavatam takes the expression of pure love for Krishna and puts it in different appropriate situations. It puts it in the level of Jnana Bhakta. It puts it in the level of Shuddha Bhakta. It puts it in the level of Prema Bhakta. It puts it in the level of Prema Turua Bhakta and Para Prema Turua Bhakta. Different levels of intimacy. But the result is you get to understand that concept. What is sacrifice, surrender, affection, and love for God. And you begin to see and understand its beauty, which inspires you to seek that. We know that in our hearts, that what we want more than anything else is to have a selfless, loving heart and a relationship with an appropriate object to repose or express that love. That's why in the Nectar of Devotion, in the very beginning, when Prabhupada is explaining, and he asked that question, where to repose that love, where it's fully satisfied, it's God. Because God is inclusive of everything. And opposing our love in God expands that love eternally and expansively and universally. So as the Bhagavatam does that, the Brihad Bhagavatamrita does that also. The names are changed. You know, the story is the same. It's the same story. The form is a little condensed. It summarizes it in one journey rather than 12 cantos. But you still get these various levels of devotees, which accomplish two things. One, you get to see the concept of bhakti or selfless devotion from different angles of vision, which helps you to sharpen your understanding of it. It also shows what that level of devotion is to the highest degree and promotes it, obviously, which is bhaja bhakti. Just a kind of a side story in terms of scholarship. 1982, right? So was that 29 years ago? I got it right. I think it's 29 years ago. you know, I was in Mayapur, actually, at this time of the year. And at that time, there was no conflict between ISKCON and the Gaudiya Math or anything. And a friend of mine, actually, he was being worked to the bone and had a lot of problems with the authority. He was kind of getting fried out in many ways. So he went to see Prabhupada's godbrother, Srila Bhakti Rakshakya Sridharmaj, who is a great Vaishnava, a great Vaishnava scholar. Highly recommend his books. So he gave a nice answer to my friend. You know, my friend said, you know, I'm just going to crack under the pressure, you know. And he encouraged him to try his hardest to cooperate. But at the end, he said, but don't starve. But don't starve. Very practical advice. You try your hardest, but don't kill yourself. But anyway, somehow my friend said, look, I'm going. You would like to see him? And I kind of, okay, I'll go. So I went over there, and he was sitting in his ashram. And he was a very, very renounced person. You could tell by every aspect. And sitting on the second floor of his little temple on a chokhi, a little wood bed. And they introduced me as the head of the Gurukul. So he was perfect English. He's very aware. The first thing he said to me is, how is Pradyumna? Because everyone loved Pradyumna, and Pradyumna spent time with so many great Vaishnavas. And then he said, Gurukula, the ancient system of, you know, Indian education. And then, for about 15 minutes, he took that concept of traditional education and put it in so many places. I mean, he put it in the Bhagavatam, he put it in the Ramayana, he put it in sociology, he put it in modern philosophy, he put it in pedagogical theory. I mean, it was just going all over, and it was really one of the most satisfying intellectual experiences I've ever had. And then after he finished, he looked at me and said, yes, go take prasadam. And then he started to explain prasadam tattva and brought it into the shastras, brought it into my, you know, it was wonderful. So that's what good scholarship does. And good devotional scholarship takes a particular point and helps you understand it by referencing it to other verses that express the same point, to stories that illustrate the same point, to different circumstances where that point is applied. So the first part of the Brihad Bhagavatamrita did that with the concept of devotee. And the second part of Brihad Bhagavatamrita would do that with the concept of the place that facilitates different gradations of devotion. And there's a very, very important correlation, which we can even see practically within our lives. It's really what Vrindavan means. Vrindavan means that God is Akhila Rasamrita Murti. It's a very, very beautiful description of the Absolute Reality. Akhila, complete, Rasamrita, of the nectar of relationships, Murti, he's the embodiment. God is the embodiment of love, and that means varieties of love. And those varieties of love require appropriate settings to blossom to its fullest extent. And we just see practically in the world that our familial relationships require a particular setting. and the setting is a stimulus, and it's a stimulus, and it's a facility to exchange a particular type of love. And therefore, we like the place because it's intrinsically related to a particular love, which is the pleasure that we relish in this life. So, of course, the common logic is, if it's the basic principle here, then why should it not exist in the ultimate reality, its source? And that's the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. And that's what this is about, the place that facilitates it. I've discussed that in other classes. The place is important. It creates the mood that facilitates a particular exchange of love. And that is our reality. Our reality is we're meant for an exchange of love, an exchange of perfect love with everything, with God. Prema Pramartha Mahan. And that is the greatest value. It makes so much sense. The greatest value is the greatest love. And what does the greatest love require? It requires the greatest object of love. And that's all facilitated. So, as we remember, Uttara's question here, and it has been a very difficult section for me, but was remember, Uttara is asking about this. She's heard about the topmost place, Teplos Devotee, and now she wants to understand the topmost place. And to put that question in context, she expresses her own understanding to her teacher of the gradation and correlation of the love you have and the place that facilitates it, and how there's a gradation of purity of heart and exaltation of place. So she's expressed this and raised some doubts. I found this section very difficult. I couldn't really hone in. I understood what's being talked about, but I didn't understand its level of significance. Of course, I fault myself. It's not that it doesn't have a level of significance. It's just that I haven't understood it through my frame of reference. And that's what faithfulness means. Faithfulness means that when you accept a authority of truth and your understanding of that particular truth does not satisfy your analysis of that concept or understanding, you don't reject the authority, you question your own ability and capacity to understand what is being said. Let's assume there is truth. Let's assume there is authority. So one defect is not being faithful. If you're not being faithful, many true things you will reject as truth when you don't have the capacity to fully understand it as truth. And if you're not thoughtful, when something doesn't appear to be truth, even though it's truth, if you're not thoughtful,
have to think about this deeply. I just sometimes, if you're not thoughtful and if you're not faithful, so let's begin again. When you're not faithful, when you hear truth, when you hear something that doesn't correspond to the truth, you will reject the validity of the source of that truth. In other words, there's truth, but if you're not faithful, just because it doesn't, just because you don't understand it is truth, but if you don't have faith, then you'll reject the authority of that truth. And if you're not thoughtful, what will happen when you hear truth and you don't understand it as truth? When you're not thoughtful, you'll accept what you've heard is true. You'll accept what you heard is true, even though it may be, your understanding of it may be wrong. You won't get your doubts cleared. Faithfulness and thoughtfulness. Anyway, so we've come to the point where she kind of understands that she, because they got to the point of Vaikuntha where love is perfect, there's a variety of love, but they're all perfect, but there's a gradation of moods. I think, yeah, it's expressed here. One second. No, I can't find it. I just need to find something here. Somehow. It says, therefore, since various levels of sadhana bring various degrees of perfection, it is undeniable that in Vaikuntha, where happiness reaches its ultimate limits, some devotees enjoy more happiness and some less. And the final issue, those who practice the highest mode of the Lord's devotional service achieve one last extreme of perfection, the ecstasy known only by those whose love focuses exclusively on the lotus feet of the divine paramour of the gopis. Relative to this, the position of all other devotees is inferior, but it's still perfect. Because it's perfect in that person's capacity and function. They have a particular way of loving God, and it's perfect. So she finally gets to the point, discusses Vaikuntha, but says there must be something special for this because of the intensity and intimacy of this love. What place does it manifest? What is that place? And because if you understand the place, then you'll also find that love. Because the particular love is manifest in a particular place. If you find that place, you'll find that love. So here, it describes such people chant the names of Krishna. Let in a second. And they are indifferent to everything else, and they want only to become servants of Sri Radha. They're indifferent to everything else that is external to the truth. And that's what perfection means. Perfection means, perfection means pure. When everything external to us is removed. Perfect water is pure water. Perfect person is a person who has realized the soul. And they only want to become servants. And they have the sadhana of chanting the names. Kirtan is an expression of love. It's a symptom of love and it's the cause of love. Okay, next verse. Anyesham ivatesham cha prapyam chedrin the chityati aho nanda yasoda dir nasahe tadjusam gatim. If those special devotees attain only the same perfection as others, my heart will be left discontent. For such devotees as Nanda and Yasoda to reach only the same destination, to me the very thought is intolerable. So, Uttara wants to see the Lord's reciprocation to those who love him the most. And it somehow disturbs her. And one becomes disturbed when there are things that challenge one's faith. We all have this if we're practicing Krishna consciousness. And we've accepted a particular authority and line of truth when there are things that appear to contradict what in our frame of reference we consider truth. We're disturbed because partial faith, and this is actually Lao Tzu, partial faith is not faith at all. It's not trust in that sense. It's not trust in the sense that one begins to put one's own authority above the authority that one has been accepting. So it's a problem when doubts arise. That's what doubts are considered like demons sometimes. So, of course, again, when one has sufficient experience in relationship with authority, that what they profess is a truth higher than their own perception. And when one has an experience of that and a history of that, Then when something arises from that authority that appears to belie one's sense of truth, one doesn't get disturbed. Because if there's that faith, then one only doubts one's understanding. And I've had this experience in my own spiritual life in relationship to Srila Prabhupada. I have a fertile intellect, and sometimes from my own perspective or my own understanding, I did not understand. And things that were said or done were not what I would have said or done. Were not what I would have seen or trusted. But because there was a sufficient experience of the authority of Srila Prabhupada in my life above my own perception, I tended to more doubt my own understanding than the authority of the source of that knowledge. And I would have to say, in time, again and again, I have realized things that previously I hadn't been able to understand and view as truth. So here it's no doubt when there is some apparent contradiction between your foundation of understanding and truth and the line of authority that you accept as representing the truth, then there could be disturbance. So here, Uttar is expressing that. Of course, what her expression is if it remains as it is right now, I am disturbed. What she's really saying is, I have faith. There must be some higher understanding of this. Please reveal it to me. There must be a higher destination for people of this expanse of intimacy and devotion, such as the Brijvasis. I want to know that place. I want to, how loving and beautiful it may be, must be, to facilitate the level of depth of love of devotees such as Nanda and Yasoda. I'm in Mayapur, but I think of Vrindavan all the time. I think of Vrindavan, sometimes more than Krishna. But it's the same. I think of the beauty of Vrindavan. In my mind, I'm always going through these forest walks where there are beautiful gardens of roses with such sweet fragrance. But to me, it's not mundane. It's very spiritual because I see those roses not just as colorful and fragrant. I see them as a color and fragrance that has an intention of pleasing Krishna. Because they're grown for the deities. They will be offered and they're grown in that consciousness. So in my mind, I'm always seeing Vrindavan and how beautiful the place is and how beautiful the people in that place are. When you just have a little perspective and a little direction where to enter into that place. So it's so concrete to me that you cannot separate relationship from the environment that facilitates that relationship. And you can't separate the love you experience in a particular place from the place that allows you to facilitate it. The affection is equal. Commentary. Someone might propose that Sri Mathura Puri, like a yogi in Dwarka, may be located in Vaikuntha. The devotees of Radha and Krishna may thus have their Vaikuntha Gokula, where they can enjoy pastimes with the Lord and feel happiness greater than that of the Yadavas, just as the Yadavas enjoy happiness greater than that of the Pandavas. Uttara, however, is not satisfied with this proposal. She cannot tolerate having the devotees of Gokul categorized with other ordinary Vaishnavas. So I guess there's also here a mood of her appreciation and love, because every devotee has a particular experience and affection for God. And that gives one I wouldn't call it a prejudice, but it gives one a particular liking and a particular appreciation. But what happens in the Shastras, because devotees are non-envious, even though they may have a particular relationship with Krishna, they can appreciate other relationships as more intimate without being, wanting to change the particular relationship that they're in. A mother may love a child, and the child may have a lover, and the mother may also appreciate the lover and the intimacy of that, if she really loves her child. Dhanam mahinam hi yatra kasta para para kotinam paryavasyanti samudre sarato yata. Varied and countless excellences flow into those devotees like rivers into the ocean. So, what does Krishna mean, Swayam Bhagavan? It means that personality of Godhead when he's fully manifest in all his beauty, of the varieties of love he has, which necessarily means a variety of activities he has, which necessarily means the full expanse of the beauty he has and the full expression of that beauty. And the same thing goes with the devotees. Those devotees who have the most intimate relationship with God, the variety of their activities and the sweetness of their love becomes unparalleled. Commentary, all varieties of perfection are fully manifest in the devotees of Gokula. Those devotees are perfectly beautiful, charming, and graceful, and they are endowed with the valuable assets of religious duty, economic development, sense gratification, renunciation, knowledge, realization, devotion, and pure love of God. All these perfections are present within them to the utmost degree possible for finite beings. Whenever Sri Brihad Bhagavatamrita depicts the glories of devotees lesser than the residents of Gokul, its purpose is to highlight the glorious, greater glories of the Gokul Vasis and demonstrate that all varieties of excellence flow ultimately into the residents of Gokul, just as the waters of all rivers flow at last into the ocean. Are there any questions?
Maharaj?
Muni, Hare Krishna, yes.
Dandava Pranams, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
I have a few questions if there's time, but one of them, I'm not sure how to put it. This is not exactly like a challenge, but it makes, anyway, I'll just get it out and see what you think.
Because I myself have difficulty understanding these particular sections, you know, but so I like discussion of them. I think they may elucidate them more.
Well, I appreciate the way in which you brought up quite a bit, it seems, today, the way in which we have to navigate a kind of belief system in our practice. And, you know, in a few ways it came up. One is it came up when you were talking about how, you know, when something is philosophically, when something is philosophical, it helps you clarify a concept by illustrating that concept from various perspectives. And also when you were talking about the kind of faithfulness versus thoughtfulness, thank you. And I want to ask you a question about the latter, and then if there's time, about the former. And again, Marsh, this is a challenge, but I'm just going to put it like this is going to be a dialectic, so I'm going to
put it
for you to respond to. It seems to me that, like you had brought up the point that there's times where you've doubted things, or not doubted, but when you found things, Prabhupada said, problematic from your own perspective, and that, but because you are a disciple who's seen your own mistakes, you kind of withheld judgment, and in time you saw that he was right about something. First, I just want to say that's my own experience too, and I've seen a number of times just in a more mundane where I was really convinced about something, and then it just took a certain conversation or a certain experience to show me how limited my own understanding was, and then it made me kind of doubt what I was so sure about. So I think that leads one to be a bit more humble in certain ways. But I guess what I want to bring up, the kind of challenging thing or whatever, is I've seen devotee friends go through crises, and probably I've gone through these when I was younger too, because you have a conception of the guru as some kind of magical oracle of truth who can never be wrong. And therefore, you know, you get frustrated because it seems like there's times where there's something where clearly they don't have all the facts and yet they pass judgment or something like that. And I worry about that, Maharaj, because I do think we have a tendency, and again, I invite you to push back on this, really, but I think we have a tendency to project our hopes into the guru and things like that in ways that are unrealistic and actually not even traditional. Project our kind of ideals. Project our ideals or hopes. You know, where we expect the guru could never make a mistake, is not affected by history, all that stuff. But I don't think that's a proper historical view of the guru. It seems to me to be, you know, maybe the product of a lot of young people who had, you know, I don't know. And so, I don't know. I wanted to ask you, what about this fact?
I want to get a perspective on this. I think one thing is I think there's kind of a difference between I wish I had this story by Sridhar Maharaj and Bhakti Siddhanta, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He dealt with something like this, where he got something wrong or something, and how he dealt with it. But I think there's two things. There's one, I think there's a few things here. One, obviously, you know, someone maybe got the facts wrong, you know, but their concept is right, but the facts were wrong, you know. You know,
uh-huh.
Someone came in and said something and the person commented on it, but the facts were wrong. So that's one aspect, you know, so that's a possibility also that, you know, the philosophy is right, but the application is wrong because the person is fed the wrong facts.
Yeah.
I think that's quite possible. The second thing is, and I think you spoke about this with your guru, you know, Acharya Mam Vijanayam Navamanye Dukarya, you know, we should accept Acharya as my very self, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, that verse doesn't even refer to the guru. It refers to anyone who's, you know, in a position of authority. So there's a certain culture that is required, you know. So that one is not just left with his limited perception as the ultimate judgment. You know, so there is a certain culture that is promoted. I remember, and you'll remember this also, in when we had our Sherban gathering, right? And Radha Vallabha was giving a presentation on Prabhupada's Gita, right?
Yeah.
And he had researched different people who criticized Prabhupada's Gita. There was one guy, Professor Bard, right, who wrote Bhagavad Gita as it was, right? I mean, there's different things. General devotees don't understand this, right? And, you know, there was a question also, you know, about Prabhupada's use of language and how effective it is in promoting an understanding, you know, the rascal scientist and, you know, the whole thing. And, you know, I always, you know, and you remember I was sitting there and I, you know, and as my archetypal role in these things, not feeling very comfortable. Yeah. Yeah, not that my faith was shaken. But in the same sense, it was a scholarly, you know, meeting. You know, that's what it is. You know,
yeah.
People, you know, look at things from different angles. Otherwise, what's the use of having a scholarly meeting? You know, but there's also that. But then I remember at that time, you know, I called up Pradyumna, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Pradyumna is very well-versed in Shastra. I mean, extremely well-versed in Shastra. But because he's so well-versed in Shastra, he's also well-versed in the culture that Shastra represents, you know. And when I expressed it to him, you know, he was, you know, appreciating the discourse, but also wanted to make sure that the devotees did not lose the culture of respect that is also required to have deeper understanding. You know, deeper understanding requires two things. Again, okay, you have to be thoughtful, because if you're not thoughtful, right, you'll be accepting all kinds of things that are wrong. You won't just be finding, if you're not thoughtful, you won't just be exposing, you know, truth. It's not truth, you know, but if you're not thoughtful, if you're not thoughtful, let me try to get this right, because this is such a deep point. If you're not thoughtful, you know, what will happen is, if you're not faithful, right, you know, you will not
be able to decipher and understand things that are true that go beyond your perception, you know, and it's going to definitely limit your ability to understand truth. And if you're not thoughtful, you're not going to be able to discriminate what is proper authority. And if you're not thoughtful, you're also not going to be able to understand, you're not going to be able to detect when you haven't understood something deep enough, you know? If you're not thoughtful, you're not going to be able to detect that. You're going to, you know, Prabhupada said, and you're going to understand it in the wrong way, and you're not going to have the mental acumen to actually figure out that you need to understand this more deeply to really understand what the person said. So the mechanism of faith is so important in knowledge, that balance. So what Pradyumna said, and then Pradyumna gave the example of that culture. He said that even, you know, sometimes great scholars go back 300 years and find mistakes in commentaries of great acharyas, even grammatical mistakes or sometimes where they said something wrong. I just read a purport today in the class. I'm doing something on the 10th canto where Prabhupada translated Hamsa as duck, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Hamsa means swan. So when I was in the
actually,
class,
actually, Marge, it means goose. There's a Himalayan goose. But anyway.
Okay. Just silly.
Well, but it's not a duck, Marge. There's a really, I had a conversation with Patrick Olivelle, who's a modern Sanskritist, about this. He said that it's a special goose that can fly over the Himalayan mountains and stuff, so it's not an ordinary goose either.
Yeah.
But he said swan is not really the best either.
Well, just look, Prabhupada translated as duck. I thought it was swan, and I didn't want to say duck.
Well,
but anyway, it kind of touches on the point, but a little bit in a way. So what I'm saying is that you know, it's such. He gave the example, Virginia, that in previous commentary, you know, the person would go and he would find something that was wrong. You know what I'm saying? He'd find something was wrong. It's not that, you know, the person had the wrong conclusions or the thing, whatever. He may have missed a word, or he may have not known a particular logic, or whatever the case is, or may have got it wrong, or whatever the case is. But the person, you remember Pradyumna said, would never say the person's wrong. They would correct it, and they would say like this, Rishi Uchu. The sage said this, and then he would say what he says. Anyways,
you mean
correct.
he wouldn't call him out by name, you're saying? Is that why they say Rishi Uchu? Because they're not going to...
No, he wouldn't call him out by name. He wouldn't correct him. He would give reference that this person said this and I say this. You know what I'm saying? He wouldn't say he is wrong, this is right. He would just say what that person said, then he would say what he said. In other words, Pradyumna's point was, it's not that he just wouldn't call him out by name. He just wouldn't call him out. He would respect. He would have so much respect. In other words, he was saying there was a culture of faith. And then, you know, he gave the other example of Professor Sanyal, you know, and who was faithful to Bhakti Siddhanta, and, you know, and Pradyumna was expressing it as appreciation of the faith, that, you know, when he went to, the, you know, some editor and they wanted to change it, and it was a particular word, and Bhakti Siddhanta used it in a particular way. And then the editor said, well, you know, the dictionary says this. And then he said, change the dictionary. Now, you know, Pradyumna was just illustrating that. I mean, we can go and say, wait, why didn't he? He was illustrating that to say that there's a particular culture. So, you know, you have to respect the culture of faith because it's so important in learning.
Yeah, Marge, I think I appreciate your bringing our awareness to this, the importance of this, but I feel like in a way it's secondary, because Pradyumna himself is willing in conversation to recognize things that he thinks are limited in previous thinkers. He just does so in a profoundly respectful way. I think he'd feel uncomfortable if we were talking about him in this forum. I'm not going to bring him up again, but I think that what I'm getting at is that I think you can have a culture of respect, but the main issue remains here, which is the province of the authority of the people in question. So, for example, Srila Prabhupada told his disciples he needed their help to edit his books because he didn't know English as well as they did, right? So if someone kept using English the way Prabhupada did in 1965 or something, because they thought that was being faithful to Prabhupada, that would indicate to me a lack of thoughtfulness to the degree that's almost pathological. Prabhupada was not an authority about English. He was not an authority about English grammar, although he was pretty good at it compared to most people.
Okay, I mean, this is not a very difficult issue at all.
But it's not, because once we start that, then we look down the line and see that even great authorities, there's a province for their authority, and the province may not be details of the ordinary world.
That's fine. That's not an issue. That's not a difficulty at all.
But that's what I'm trying to ask you about.
There is a province of their authority, obviously.
Yeah.
There's a province of their authority. I think that's not so much of an issue. You know? I would say that's good. Yeah, there's a province of their authority. They're not historians. They may comment without a lack of fact. But let's put it this way. There is a province of their authority that we should have. If you accept them as authority, you should have faith in, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. That's not a problem. That's not challenging at all, as far as I can see.
Well, I guess, but I started this by saying it seems like it's not an uncommon sort of kind of growing pain that I've seen people go through, and I felt it myself a little bit a long time ago, that you have an image of the guru that's in some ways artificial, that somehow they're like an oracle. The super soul just gives them truths, and they can't get things wrong. They're not historically grounded or something. They don't have a connection with history. They're above history. But I'm putting this forth as saying I think that's naive, and it leads people, it harms people's faith because they project the wrong image, because they have the misunderstanding of the province. You think that's true?
Okay.
So then in that sense, the faithfulness and thoughtfulness also, I guess, requires us to navigate sometimes those situations where we have to look at the context of a guru or a teacher's words, maybe realize there's a contextual basis that may not apply to us, and yet still be faithful and realize that it doesn't mean that the spirit of what they're saying is not something we should really have faith in. I'm just thinking aloud. I mean, I think you'd say, yeah.
I think it's great, and I think, there's also a danger that you enter into their province. So it's a fine line, And therefore, faith is promoted. And sometimes if it's a little overextended, it may not be so unhealthy either. You know what I'm saying? In the culture. I mean, it's natural it'll be a little bit overextended sometimes, because it's a fine line. What is their province? You could open it up in a way that, again, this is the danger. You open it up in a way where people start relying on their own perceptions when their intelligence is not purified, So I do think the culture does give a strong promotion of faith, and Charyamam Vijanayam, it asks one to see people in a very, very, that represent, are supposed to be teachers. There is a big promotion of a kind of approach and a submissiveness and an acceptance, et cetera. I think the problem lies, right, when people take positions which they are not qualified for and then misuse them or abuse them. And that's, I think, the history that we're experiencing, that, when faith is decimated, then, you know, people are left in a very empiric view of things that limits their ability to, you know, access truth and that's beyond their perception, you know. So anyway, I just think these are just, I agree with you, and I think we kind of have a basic agreement. There's a certain province, but I think we have to have a certain agreement also of the necessity of a culture of faith, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, your kids and you know. You know so much more than them. You know, you're older than them. You're more experienced to them. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You may get something wrong, but it's kind of not as important as them really trusting you if you are sincere and have their objectives and really do know a lot more than them. You know what I'm saying? You know?
Yeah, I agree, but also I feel like because I know they trust in me, I'm willing to be corrected by them and also give them confidence in their own faculties because there's a background of trust. You know what I mean? If there wasn't trust, then there'd be this anxiety about their confidence. But because there is that trust, I kind of encourage them to be critical because I already know it's not,
okay.
Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like if one has faith, then we're
being
critical.
That's from your side.
But I'm saying I think
Which
it's a similar
good.
Case, though. But I'm saying it's a similar case that it's like if you have faith, it's like the people I know who don't get hung up on things that Prabhupada said that seem to be empirically not correct are people who have such faith in him that they don't see it as a big deal. Because they have a deep faith in what he, in his actual contribution to their spiritual life. They're the ones who, they can say, oh yeah, whatever, you know. They're not the ones who feel like they have to fight to their dying breath, you know, to defend something which is kind of irrelevant. So in a way, I feel like I'm agreeing with you that it's when one's faith is properly grounded, then one has the kind of foundation where one can think critically without maybe a certain kind of danger. Do you disagree with that?
My point was different.
My
point was a little different. And
well,
my point was is the necessity for a culture of faith. You bring up another point, which may also be valid, but there's a necessity for a culture of faith, you know, and I'd use the example of your children for that, how healthy
yeah.
it is that they do trust, and that yeah. there is a culture in your house about that, you know. You're an arch conservative. No, I'm just joking.
Oh,
we'll go.
Please.
Any other
Amongst
questions?
The devotees, I'm a flaming liberal. I don't even know. Anyway,
okay.
All right, Marish, I appreciate your point. There was a second thing, but, you know, I've taken a lot of your time now, so I'd be happy to shelve it. If you want.
I appreciate when you go. It makes the Sangha interesting because this section, you know, it's kind of like I understand the point, you know what I'm saying, but I don't really have much more to say about it. You know, because it's not almost an intellectual point here, and I'm, you know, that, you know, she has these sentiments, you know. I hope the text, as I remember, will get into things that will lead to more, something more, I think, you know, kind of I can express in a more relevant way. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Thanks, Marsh.
Okay, great. Mooney, I may give you a call after this just to touch base. Anybody else like to say
something? Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Gail.
Gail, Hare Krishna.
Yeah, I just wanted to express my appreciation for your very heartwarming and thorough explanation of the essence of the Bhagavatam and Bhagavatamrita. And,
you wrote me a question, but the super soul directed me to answer it in the class.
Uh-huh.
All glories to the super soul. All glories to the super soul again, good to go.
Was it the super soul?
It was. I wasn't planning on answering your question. Only after I began talking about it, I realized, wait a second, Gail just wrote me about this.
Really?
Was. Yeah.
Really?
Oh, because I could have sworn that it was because you read my question that you had this class.
No, not at all.
That's unbelievable.
No, that's what happened. And when it was happening, I was saying, oh, it's a super soul. Arrange this to answer that question. I was watching it happen. It's not easy it's not easy to give class at night, especially I'm in Mayapur. And every day I'm invited to prashad in a different place. By the time the evening comes around, I'm pretty exhausted here. But anyway, I was just listening. So I'm giving class and I'm listening to myself. I'm, hey. Somehow Gail's question was answered. How nice. Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. And I really appreciated the points that was brought out in your interchange with Mahamuni. That was really great, too.
Okay. Which point did you appreciate?
I appreciated, one of the points I appreciated was the fact that, the importance of having faith, you know, in order to access truth, but the fact that there's a fine line between, you know, in using your discriminatory faculties, where if you cross that line, then it can erode the faith that you need in order to access that faith. I mean, you know, you can have it. You can discriminate, you know, to realize that, well, maybe they applied the right principles to the wrong facts. But, you know, a little overextension is not bad, you know, because it keeps your faith intact, you know, in order for you to access earning. But, you know,
Yeah, good.
Yeah, you know, in other words, you don't have to, you know, ignore your intellect, but you don't want to have it get in the way of having the faith that you need to access.
Very well said. Okay, that's nice getting feedback from you, because I think you've got a balanced understanding. Anyway, thank you, Gail. Thank you so much.
Thank you also so much.
Okay. Hare Krishna. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my most humble obeisances.
Hare Krishna, Nanda Dilal. I'm definitely going to come over your way this year.
Okay. Thank you, Maharaj. Thank you.
Maybe Gail can fly up at the same time. Then we can have such nice discussions on Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Sure, Maharaj.
Gail's very fond of your wife as one
Thank
of her
you, Maharaj.
Guides.
She's most welcome. You know, she should just tell us, you know, when she can be available.
We can discuss Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Sure.
Very nice. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hari Bell, Maharaj, Chaitanya Priya.
Well, I haven't heard from you for a while, but nice to hear from you. Great. Good. Still in Portland, Seattle, or?
Portland,
okay. Okay, Hare Krishna. Wonderful.
Hare Krishna.
Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj, this is Brajaradhe Devdasi.
Thank you so much. Nice to hear from you. Should be back.
Thank you.
Let's see. And we're going to be back in March. We'll do program there. Okay. Anyone else like to say hello?
Hare Bo Maharaj, Shastra Das.
Puri's coming right up, Shastra.
Can't wait.
Working.
Can't wait.
I'm working with Madhavananda to, you know, make a really nice schedule. And one evening, We're going to have Nityananda. He just did a translation on and commentary on Sri Kali Komadi. He's going to make a presentation of that. I think we'll have some interesting stuff. Some nice kirtans. Okay. Anybody else like to come to Puri? You're all welcome. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, it seems like people are trying to be ready to help.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Henry, Hare Bal. Hi, where's the Prabhupada? Okay, thank you. I have an interview that was done for a book I was writing with Muna on kirtan. And it's really nice. I put it out on my it's on my website. You should take a look at it if you haven't seen it already. You'd really appreciate it. And in the Women of Bhakti film that Jonathan did with Hillary, fantastic presentation. It's dedicated to Jamuna. And it ends with her, too. So it's great. Okay. Hare Krishna. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, Vanshikopla, Rubya Shaka, Kasindu, Vishwapati.